You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we won't hand this episode off to another producer to re-edit the fuck out of it after we record it. If you enjoy your trip into the midside here today, please tell a friend. Referrals are our number one source of tourism, even though Daniel hates that fucking metaphor. I'm your host, Justin Emlesneski.
To be fair to me, I only hate bad metaphors. So,
how dare you? As you can see, joining me this trip is Daniel T. Richards from our nation's capital.
And I am tired. So tired.
Are you allowed to say why you're so tired, what you've been doing the past few days?
Just a three-day, almost all-day work conference that I basically worked from 6 or like 5:45 in the morning to 11:30 every night.
And that's an Eastern time.
So I'm Madeline Kahn tired is how tired I am.
Yeah, you guys were in high gear. You actually, your people used Snapchat. I was like, oh my God, Snapchat.
We were firing on all social media cylinders. All of them. Instagram, Snapchat, Twitters, Facebook, live streaming, and other things that I don't even remember at this point. A hashtag printer. We had a hashtag printer, Justin.
Yeah, I didn't know what that was, and I just ignored it because they were like, use our hashtag printer. And I was like, okay.
When you tweet or Instagram a photo and you use the official hashtag, which I will not say what it was, then it would print that photo out automatically and we'd tack it to a board and you could come pick it up if you wanted on beautiful souvenir paper.
Interesting. That is an interesting idea.
Thank you. I strive for interesting and not good.
I don't know if it's good. I'd have to see it. But that's a whole other discussion for a whole other show. And I have another co-host to introduce.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Joining us from somewhere in the Bay in the South. I honestly don't even know where exactly he lives anymore because he moves so often.
Where's William?
Midsider William.
Yes, I like to keep my location vague to stay away and hide from the SJWs.
Is that part of information security?
That's right. It's kind of a challenge, basic hacking challenge, just to find me.
That's how you know you're good at your job, when it just becomes your modality of living.
Well, it's kind of a security through obscurity, so it's not the best way to be secure, but it works for me.
And that's how you know that I am ignorant of what your job is. Let's talk about a bunch of shit that I'm probably super ignorant about, but going to run my mouth about anyway. It's time for the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
Grab your pussy hats, throw them in a backpack, and come to D.C. Because pretty soon leftists are going to have their own hotel. An anti-Trump hotel for quote-unquote liberals.
That's discrimination.
This is what it's come to. This is what it's come to. Really, it has. Bloomberg reports that you can expect a counterculture art, progressive fireside chats, and craft materials for your next great protest poster. Yes, indeed. The first thing you'll see when you walk into Eaton Workshop, a hotel opening in late 2018 in D.C., is a custom-commissioned video art installation. Shown on a series of vintage-style television screens that show presidential elections of 2012 and 16 that's built around one pointed question: how did our country get where it is today? It's not a subtle statement, and it's not meant to be, because Eaton is a hotel built specifically around the resistance, la resistance. It is a hotel for the left, and unabashedly so. They basically argue that in this world of hyper-politicization and political activism, there is room for a quote-unquote conscious hotel to do the right thing. Justin, have you reserved your room?
After last week and the shaming I received for my almost supportive of Trump comments, I think I might have to book a room here to redeem myself with the Midsiders and with the general public.
That's right. That's right.
I mean,
well, book it up quick because it's going to sell out.
Is it? Is it going to sell out? Is it? I mean, I don't know.
Think of the hubris here.
They have six straight months of selling out.
And then think of the hubris here. They really think they're the first liberal to own a hotel in D.C.
Right, and the Trump Hotel's just down the road.
And the idea, and the idea that in D.C. that they're the resistance is just baffling.
Yes.
Well, that's right. Part of their whole ethos, this idea that we're always the resistance no matter what. I mean, I've seen that since I was young, is they've always believed they were the resistance and they were the counterculture. I mean, that's part of their identity. That's what I want to talk about in a second. But first I want to say, if the Trump Hotel is right down the street from this hotel, is this going to turn into like an episode of Muppets Tonight where they're like cannons come out of the walls and they start shooting at each other?
Oh, man.
One can
you
only
joke
hope.
Now, but the kind of crazies that this is going to attract, I mean, I imagine the kind of person that wants to go to this hotel and make protest posters and the kinds of triggly puffs that will show up. This is going to attract some real crazies on the far left. And then forget about the trolls. 4chan is going to love to troll this kind of hotel.
Oh yeah. This is just going to be target number one for the 4chan.
That's how I can't help support 4chan when they're trolling like that. And I agree with you completely, William, about that this is for extreme people. But the existence of this is exactly why I wanted to cover that story last week, Daniel, the story that I got a lot of blowback on, the whole idea that maybe Trump like doesn't cheat on his wife. Like maybe there's like one good thing about him.
Just stop saying it.
The problem I have is hating Trump, and this even goes back to hating Bush when I was at Ithaca and people had shirts on that said "not my president" about Bush, you know, and we've seen that refrain over and over again, and now they're saying it about Trump again. It's like, no, you're in America, it's your president. Like Obama was my president, even if I wasn't
the quaint
a fan
good
of
old da- good old days.
The problem,
the biggest insult was "not my president."
Yeah, no shit, right? Not like you're a racist rapist, but the problem I have here is this has gone beyond just disagreeing with someone and not liking their politics and even not liking them as a person. This is defining your own identity through hatred of Donald Trump. And that makes all conversation pointless and impossible. And that's the point right here. This article is demonstrative of what's wrong with the rhetoric in our culture right now and the approach to political conversation. It has been made so that hating Donald Trump is an identity, part of who you are. I don't have enough hate for any political figure currently. I don't want to say like if another Hitler came up, I wouldn't hate them. But I don't have enough hate in my heart. I don't have enough energy to hate a political figure that much to define my identity that way.
It is a special kind of secondhand, not just to identify yourself by like what others think or outside forces, but to define yourself by the thing that you dislike. That is a special kind of terrible.
So Daniel,
here's my question for this hotel is, how will they make money? Because the end of this article says the room rates will not be extravagant. Prices in Washington are likely to hover in the upper 200s a night. First, anyone who's making protest signs at a macaroni noodles cannot afford $200 a night. And two, do you understand, hotel, how fucking expensive Washington, D.C. is? At $200 a night, the people who will be staying here are like the families of 11 who come from the heartland who are trying to see the monuments. Like, this is not going to be – you are not going to get the clientele you think you're going to get.
Yeah, Daniel, I had a question for you as our D.C. expert, which I know makes you cringe. I was going to ask you about the roommates. But the more important question is, how in the hell are they going to build this hotel before Donald Trump is no longer president? I mean, think of all the permits they have to pull and all the like. There's no way this is going to get done before the hated figure is gone. This is DC we're talking about.
Are they already conceding? Are they already conceding that he's going to be reelected? Is that what's going on here?
Well, at this point, they're hoping, right, for their business model. Are they going to have to donate to his reelection campaign in order just to make money at this terrible hotel?
Well,
there is
a couple of things that, you know, when I was looking through the article, like this whole idea, like the last section is like, it's nonprofit, but better. I mean, it's got all your cliched like ideas in here, you know, like the purpose of a business is service to the community in some ephemeral sense and not, you know, to make profit, which is a definite service to the community, but that's not the main consequence. There's a lot of little things like this in this article. So I think it's really great if someone actually wants to read through it and pick, you know, kind of play a little spot the bad philosophic ideas.
Yeah. This whole a nonprofit but better thing with their philosophy, wouldn't that just mean no money whatsoever? Because I'm pretty sure nonprofit is exactly what they want a business to be. And so this hotel just needs to lose money in order to be better than a nonprofit, which I think it will. So congratulations.
Yeah, failure is always...
Speaking of
none
idiots...
None of that matters, Daniel.
Oh, okay.
None of that matters. They hate Trump. That's all that matters.
Yes.
That's all that matters nowadays.
That's right. And Trump, as we know, is a pig. Speaking of pigs... Man, I really forced that one in there. That was like a Joe Flacco throw right there. Just wobbly and terrible.
You'll win a Super Bowl eventually.
When pigs fly, a woman was kicked off a U.S. Airways flight after her emotional support pig became too rowdy. The woman was given her marching orders after her havoc-wreaking hog began walking up and down the aisles. Even attempts to strap it to an armrest failed to settle the farmyard animal on the flight from Connecticut. Yes. Indeed. People were shocked. Some people thought it was a duffel bag. But then one person said, it turns out it wasn't a duffel bag. We could smell it, and it was a pig on a leash. So I'm not sure we need much more context for this story, Justin. But what other emotional support animals will we find on planes soon?
Human beings?
You know what I thought, actually, was at some point we're going to have dogs with anxiety, and so you're going to have an emotional support dog who has an emotional support, I don't know, gopher? That's smaller than a dog. So you're going to have, like, meta-emotional support animals?
That's not too far off. I could definitely believe that happening. Just like, who didn't think, like, a pig would, like, go nuts being on an airplane? Like, did we not see this coming? Like, was this not the most obvious thing ever? Like, oh my god, a pig flipped out when you brought it on an airplane. Why would you bring a pig on an airplane?
I mean, the picture is just worth a thousand words, though, here. Because this is, just so people know, we're not talking about, like, one of those, like, little tiny, like, pet pigs. This is a real, like, you know, I wouldn't say full-size pig, but it's a large pig. It's not a heifer that you see at the farm, but it's pretty big. It's not one of those tiny little pigs.
So it's not Babe.
It's not Babe. And the picture though, the pig's face, he looks just so disappointed, like he's having to leave the plane. So
it's much more precious than it is Babe. So, it wasn't even 3 years ago that Adam Kroll was joking that he was going to bring an emotional support pelican onto planes to eat the emotional support dogs. That seems quaint at this point. That seems like an under joke.
Yeah, to be fair, I got this article from the Adam Carolla Facebook page. So
of course you did.
The show prep?
It's still a big topic of conversation, but the point is, like, if someone did bring a pelican on a plane nowadays, it'd be like, oh yeah, pelican. Totally, yeah. Emotional support animal. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I've heard
just
of others.
The idea,
like,
of, like...
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No!
Me? Okay.
Go ahead.
Just the idea of, like, strapping a pig to an armrest. At what point, like, as an airline, do you go, okay, guys, like, we're not, like, giving the service we're supposed to. If our jobs are now strapping a pig to an armrest, we've done something terribly wrong. It's like me, I'm sitting at work all day doing data entry, and it's like, okay, I've gone somewhere terribly wrong at this job that this is what I'm doing. And you would think it would be the same thing if you were a stewardess. You're like, yeah. I am now strapping a pig to an armrest. I need to reassess my life at this moment.
Yeah. Although, honestly, when I read the headline, a squealing pig forcibly removed from plane, I thought to myself, Dr. Dow was removed from yet another flight.
So that's a great callback. Also, they could have been all the people going to the Donald Trump Hotel were on this plane.
That's true. Shrill is the word that comes to mind. Speaking of shrill, it turns out that there is a trend in cyberbullying that is particularly pertinent for the Midside. And this trend is that teens are anonymously bullying themselves, a study finds. Yes, cyberbullying is not a new phenomenon, but an alarming number of teenagers are anonymously posting mean things online about themselves. About 6% of kids ages 12 through 17 have bullied themselves digitally, which also sounds terribly rapey. According to research conducted by Samir, quote, it's a new phenomenon, and this is definitely happening for teens across the U.S. We have a tendency to demonize the aggressor, but in some cases, maybe 1 in 20, the aggressor and the target are the same. This was especially pertinent in a recent case where Hannah Smith, a 14-year-old from Lichtenstein, unpronounceable English name, town. She hanged herself after months of apparent online harassment, but it turns out that 98% of the messages sent to her came from the same IP address as the computer she used, meaning either that she was bullying herself or her mother was fucking awful.
The so, phone call is coming from inside.
False dichotomy, bro.
Both good jokes, just happen to be simultaneous. In completely different directions. So, Justin, this is about 1 in 20 of teenagers, but it seems lately that it's about 4 out of 5 adults that are doing this online. Do you think that the researcher calls this a new phenomenon? But really, is it a new phenomenon?
New phenomenon. Teens masturbate wildly all the time.
Teens?
It turns out 6 out of 5 young boys jerk off. In a new phenomenon. Yes.
No, this is the anonymity we were talking about last episode. I mean, if this were not the Justice League edition, this would be the follow-up edition. This is another example of it. This is why I have the problem with it, because it's all about just how you're seen. It's not about how you actually are. And they've taken this to such an extreme that they want to be seen as the victim so badly that they literally turn themselves into victims.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing. This is why she ended up killing herself. Let me rephrase that. The pretending to be cyberbullied is not why she killed herself, but it was a cry for help which showed that she was thinking about killing herself and showed that she was suicidal.
Yeah.
She needed to believe she was the victim. That's what led to her eventual taking of her own life, the believing that she was the victim. And this is why I can't stand the anonymity, because it's literally to the point now, you could not make something more farcical. You could not write something more farcical. That the anonymity is now being used to the point that you can't tell if the Twitter egg is attacking themselves or not.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the reasons I think this is being underreported at 6% or 1 in 20 or whatever it is all these news stories lately, and there were 3 high-profile news stories about racial slurs or swastikas written on things, and within a 1-week period, all 3 of these that made national news were shown to be done by the person of the race in question, meaning in one case it was a black person writing a racial slur on a car, in another case it was a lesbian woman writing that no gays were allowed in the coffee shop, and in the third instance it was another, I think it was a young black woman in the British military who had put racial slurs up somewhere. And the whole thing is like, what drives people in your mind, Justin William, to do this? What drives, and I mean, I don't even have an understanding of what what would compel someone to bully themselves?
Well, I think...
Do you?
Well, obviously the power of Christ compels them. Go ahead, William.
I think Milo had a great video on this, talking about how most of the hate crimes, he was picking on the lesbians to be provocative, most of the hate crimes perpetrated, or a large percentage, I won't say most, a large percentage of the hate crimes reported by a bunch of lesbians that he had surveyed were all shown to be false. And I think part of it is we've always had this sort of narcissistic like victim, this narcissistic idea of getting attention, right? Like being a victim gets you attention. But in today's culture, we've like elevated that, right? Like victimhood status, it is the victimhood of Olympics. Who can be the biggest victim? And the biggest victim is the one that can actually point to these sort of things. We're very concrete bound, so in today's culture, so they can actually point to, look, I am being victimized right now, and that pushes them, that gives them the extra victim points they need to get that pseudo self-esteem. So I don't think this news article doesn't. I'm not sure that this girl who committed suicide is a good example of that, but there are certainly many others where that's the example that fits that narrative.
I agree with that, and I actually want to add on to that because I think there's something a little bit more complex going on top of that. So when you look at these people who believe they're victims, they actually believe there's a lot worse stuff going on than there is. You know, William, you brought up the idea of lesbians with the whole being oppressed thing, and you talked about race, Daniel.
Yeah.
These are people who their identity, again, maybe this could be called the identity issue or the identity addition, our identity is tied up with this. But if your identity is not tied up with something that is reflected back to you in reality, you have to then invent it to protect yourself. So what I'm saying is the rate at which these people are claiming they're being bullied is not actually true in reality. That rate does not exist. You know, we saw this even with, what was it, the catcallers edition a while ago where, you know, an actually very good-looking young woman in the Netherlands was doing it. Was tracking the fact that she was being catcalled, and it was once a day, so it wasn't happening even that frequently.
Yeah.
And these people, in order to protect themselves, need to invent this to make themselves feel okay. Oh, see, it's real, it's real, it's real. It's a way of, it's a weird sort of fucking backwards way of evasion. You create a reality to evade from actual reality. And that's the problem. This goes back to the anonymity thing and the internet thing and why I'm having such a problem with social media and don't like to be on it that much anymore personally, because so many people have just created an alternate reality in social media.
Yeah. And it's so weird because it's an alternative reality that by their own worldview is worse than the reality that they're actually living in. Like this lesbian writing that gays weren't allowed in this coffee shop. It turns out that gays were perfectly allowed in the coffee shop. But she's trying to invent a world in which they're not so she can fight against it. How about you just live in the world where gays are allowed in the coffee shop?
I would just say that she's already invented that world and she doesn't want to give it up. That's the difference.
I think it's some sort of malevolent Don Quixote, right? Like it's like they're tilting at windmills here.
It's a great way of putting it.
And it's just very malevolent.
Yeah, it goes back to the interpersonal hostility.
Yeah. A malevolent Don Quixote. I love it.
Yeah.
Speaking of malevolence and living in a world that doesn't exist, we somehow missed this article last week, so we're making up for that by giving it double time this week, at least in my own mind, in my own reality. This was
Billy Blanks of the news, double time.
Double time. This was a New York Times opinion piece by Ikao Yanaka, I think. And the title is provocative enough. The title is, Can My Children Be Friends with White People?
No.
Stop stealing Justin's thunder. Okay. So here's a bit of the article. Okay. My oldest son, wrestling with a four-year-old's happy struggles, is trying to clarify how many people can be his best friend. But even a child's joy is not immune to this ominous political period. This, first of all, yes, they fucking are. Sorry, had to interrupt there. Okay, moving on. Quote, this summer's images of violence in Charlottesville, Virginia prompted an array of questions. Some people hate others because they're different, I offer lamely. A childish but distinct panic enters his voice. But I'm not different. And here is the key paragraph, at least for the beginning part. It is impossible to convey the mixture of heartbreak and fear I feel for him. Donald Trump's election has made it clear that I will teach my boys the lesson generations old, one that I, for the most part, nearly escaped. I will teach them to be cautious. I will teach them to be suspicious. I will teach them suspicion, and I will teach them distrust. Much sooner than I thought I would, I will have to discuss with my boys whether they can truly be friends with white people. Justin, can young minority children truly be friends with white people?
Not when their mothers or parents or whoever authority figures are teaching them this shit. They're being taught how to be racist. If you're being taught how to be racist, of course you can't be friends with white people because you're a fucking racist, okay? What's interesting about this article is how it's a combination of a lot of the things we've talked about. Is this not the identity issue? Now hating Donald Trump, as believing Donald Trump is a racist, has become part of this author's identity to the fact that she's going to pass it on to kids. And then is she not inventing an alternate reality where white people are that evil and that racist?
Yeah, totally, totally. This is one of the things that, like, it's not you're trying to fight racism by basically saying that this entire class of people, all of whom come from different backgrounds, different heritages, different wealth levels, all of whom have had different struggles in their life, have had good parents, bad influences, good education, come from small cities, big cities, all of them, every single one of them, you must treat with suspicion and distrust. Fuck racism. That is a horrible lesson to teach your child about any human being ever. Horrible.
Daniel,
regardless of race, regardless of religion, regardless of any quote-unquote collective group, you are a horrible human being and a horrible parent if that is your message to your child about any group whatsoever.
Yeah, Daniel, what you're saying is individualism.
Thank you.
Right? Like, this is teaching,
yes,
like, systematized collectivism. This is judge on the collective. And it wouldn't matter. I know the typical way people think about this is, oh, just swap the races and you'll see how racist it is. But this wouldn't even matter. Like, it's you, like, take the step back and look. This is saying judge someone based on the collective and based on a surface issue.
Yes. Judge them not only collectively, but judge them on a non-essential. A non-essential collective issue. Like, it would be, look, it would still be wrong, it would still be immoral, but it would be one step less non-essential if you said all Christians are bad people. Because at least Christianity is a set of ideas, right? Race is not a set of ideas. Race is something you have no control over whatsoever. It's the same as saying all blonde people are terrible or all people with green eyes are terrible. It's a non-essential. All people with club feet are terrible. Like, it's something you don't have a choice
over. Well, we all already know all Ohio State fans are terrible, but that's the exception that proves the rule.
Well, yeah, goes without saying. So, Justin, what are you going to teach your children about white people?
That there are no white people. We've been over this. How many times do I have to go over this? Like, yes. Do I need to go on this rant again? The idea that we're all one homogenous group of people, all white people are the fucking same. I actually was messaging with a Midsider this week, and it brought that out to me again. Midsider Conrad was talking to me about his Polish heritage and what it's like being Polish. And some of the things he said, I was like, wow, that explains a lot about my childhood and, like, the way my dad acted and everything. And it's like, you wouldn't say that about every Polish group, right? You wouldn't say, or every Polish group. You wouldn't say that about every white person. So no, I'm not going to, like, I don't know. Were you, let me turn it back on you guys. Were you guys taught that you were all white? It was never, we were white. It was, you were Polish, you're Italian, you know, you have French in your background. It was never, you're white growing up, ever.
Well, to be fair, I'm Mexican, so.
But what about the half of you that isn't?
That half, the oppressor half?
Yeah.
It was never an issue. It was always Italian, Irish, Polish. Like my family is a weird mutt mixture on my mother's side. French Canadian. Like, who the fuck would sleep with a French Canadian? But apparently someone in my family did.
That's really weird. Your half white is very similar to my complete being. That's really weird.
Yeah, I think for...
Yeah, it's this strange conglomeration of whiteness.
I have very similar sort of experience. There was no you are white growing up. My family was all, you know, most of my family came from basically sharecropping cotton in South Carolina. Like, if I have any identity, it's a Southern sort of South Carolina sort of heritage. You know, I eat cornbread and not stuffing at Thanksgiving. This whole idea of some sort of whiteness that I have, I'm still looking for my white privilege.
This is a great paragraph as well that we can react to, which is history. This is quote: history has proved little reason for people of color to trust white people in this way, and these recent months have put in the starkest relief the contempt with which the country measures the value of racial minorities. End quote. Did we not just have a black president? I know that's become a cliche, but even if all the minorities in the country voted uniformly for Barack Obama, which they did not, but even if they did, it would not have been enough to elect him president without the votes of white people. What is going on here?
You know, there's...
This is insane to me.
There is a weird... There's two things I wanted to talk about in this article. The first one, and you've transitioned nicely to it, is Obama was supposed to have transformed into a post-racial culture, right? And so this whole article, apparently, presidents can just undo that transformation because Donald Trump has now transformed us into some sort of racially charged... black and white violence everywhere. Like this transformation has been completely undone, and apparently a president has this power. But they're sort of like saying Obama didn't have that power if he was supposed to bring us a post-racial culture. The other thing is, and Justin, you probably have something to say about this. This entire article is just pure emotionalism. It's just, you know, it's great in the sense that it's giving you sort of the emotions that this writer and people who agree with this feel, but there's no reason, there's no facts, there's no argument. This is all just pure emotionalism.
I think your second point leads into your first point. And I think what happened is, and this is very hard to say without sort of coming across as collectivist, and I don't mean it that way. I'm just sort of talking about like people generally what they're thinking. I think there was an expectation that once we had our first black president, everything would be fixed and they would get everything they wanted. And when I say they, I mean each individual thought that they would get whatever they wanted. Oh, well, one of us is in charge now. Or, oh, somebody who is progressive as I am is in charge. So it wasn't even just a race thing, right? It was like, here's the progressive president, the leftist president we've always wanted. America is going to be fixed now. So then, afterwards, when America wasn't fixed and they didn't have what they want, because you can't just have things given to you, they couldn't accept reality. So they had to create a new fantasy. And the fantasy was, wow, America was even more racist than I believed. America was even more backwards than I believed. And then Trump got elected and they just see that as evidence of that. Oh, see, I was right. America is more racist than we believed. So having a black president wasn't enough. We have to fundamentally change America to its core. So it's a doubling down psychologically on the victim status that we were talking about earlier. And it's a doubling down on this alternate view of reality, just like we were talking about in the anonymity story. At a certain point, there are watershed moments in your life psychologically. And in those moments, you can either decide to accept reality and change yourself, or you can change your perception. How am I going to say this better? You can accept reality and change yourself, or you can refuse to accept reality, and that's it. You can refuse to accept reality and expect everybody else to change. That's what I'm trying to say. So do you see those two sides? And that's what's going on here. They're refusing to accept reality, and they want everyone else to change, rather than saying, oh, hey, maybe I was wrong.
Yeah. There can be no wrongness in the progressive movement, because that would mean that the things they've been fighting for have already been achieved, which would mean they would have no purpose, and have thus no power, which is really ultimately what it is, which is why Hillary Clinton wasn't elected because she had a vagina, and why Donald Trump is a racist because he wants immigration laws. So
a racist, sexist, rapist. Don't forget that.
That's right. A racist. Let's not start that. That's not a good one. So, I am depressed. I don't know about you. Not only am I tired, now I'm depressed. Thanks, guys.
Well, that's actually a perfect segue in to the art section. I won't say more because I don't want to spoil Justice League for you, Daniel. And Daniel, I know you didn't see it, so I'm going to have to say goodbye to you right now in this episode because we're going to go into heavy discussion of Justice League.
I'm out. Peace.
All right. Thanks, Daniel. Great as always. Great to have you. Now we're going to move on to bring a bunch of other people on the show. William's going to be sticking around with us. It's time for The Hopeful Romantic with JML. All right, midsiders out there, you knew we had to do something special, so I am bringing on a huge panel to discuss Justice League. And before we do that, we're going to do Trailer Takedown, and we actually have a surprise for you for Trailer Takedown.
Oh, man.
So, William. So as you can see, William's still here because he did, you know, do what midsiders do and see Justice League, Daniel and James. What the fuck are you guys doing? Let me just introduce a couple of our other guests here. We also have Midsider Katrina. Katrina, I'm really excited to have you on to discuss this because of your familiarity with Whedon and everything.
Pleasure to be here.
Also, we have a new voice on the show, and I have brought him on because he has seen Wonder Woman 20 times, 16 in theaters, Midsider Grant.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
And then finally, here's your surprise for Trailer Takedown. The voice of Trailer Takedown is joining us live on show, Midsider Dan.
Hello.
Don't you hear
Welcome
that? Don't
everyone.
You hear how the gravitas in his voice already?
Indeed.
So let's jump into it. Before we talk about Justice League, we're going to do some trailers.
Get ready for Trailer Takedown.
Do the first trailer one.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. First trailer.
I swear to God, nobody listens to this show. I swear to God.
I just do the recordings ahead of time and send them to you. I don't have to remember to do things.
Road Movie is a Russian YouTube compilation film. And I don't really know if there's anything else that can be said about that. It literally looks like somebody took a bunch of dash cam videos of, like, ridiculous things that happened in Russia and just did a compilation and are calling it a movie. Now, I will say this. I have thought before about how crazy it would be to just film constantly the traffic in Southern California and put that on YouTube, but to make it a movie, I don't know. Although I do appreciate that there was one point in this where there was just a random bear, and they were like, oh my God, there's a bear! And I was like, yeah, that's, like, super Russian. It's as Russian as it gets.
It was more Russian than you make it sound, because they weren't like, oh my God, it's a bear. They were like, oh God, it's a bear.
So that's probably the best part about the entire movie. So I have to tackle. Dan.
Tackle.
There we go.
I'll get better at this, I promise.
William, your turn.
I am definitely tackling. And the reason is, I think I could make this movie myself. It's a great feature on YouTube called the playlist feature. So that's all I have to say.
Tackle.
Yes, he's doing it. Katrina.
I'll be the odd one out, I guess. I totally hug this. I really am interested in watching this transition take place between... I'm not so into the found footage thing, but I'm really into alternative media and alternative ways of making art. So the fact that they're putting it into a theater is, of course, like kind of keeping one foot in the past. But I think it's kind of headed in the right direction, ironically, even though, you know, like you said, it is just a playlist feature on YouTube. So I will hug in honor of the future of entertainment.
Hug.
I love it. Katrina, you are the only person I know who has seen Hardcore Henry, so you are living your claim that you are supporting these alternative movies. All right, Grant, what's your take?
I'm not huge already on just general car crash videos. It's like, okay, cool, haha, it's funny. But to sit through however long this is going to be of them, I was going to say tackle, but actually the fact that this is combining YouTube and online media and theater makes me a slightly less tackle, but it's still going to be tackle.
Tackle?
He's even doing the variations. Now here's, can you handle this, Dan? Can you give your take and then...
your action.
Hug or tackle myself.
Then hug or tackle and then say second trailer.
Okay, all right. Whew, let's do this. So my first thought upon seeing it was that this looks like a particularly poorly produced trailer for a YouTube channel. Which I guess is kind of the point, like down to the music as well, and like the font of the type. And I was expecting it to make a turn into, oh, and now there's a story about something happening. But no, it was just a bunch of videos. And yeah, it's, I think I've seen some of those clips before. And I just, there's no idea content to this aside from here's a bunch of weird stuff that happened. Isn't humanity chaotic and pointless? Yeah, tackle. Second trailer.
The Greatest Showman is a film about P.T. Barnum starring Hugh Jackman and Zendaya when she actually looks like a woman. Take notes, oh. Marvel, how beautiful Zendaya can be. You fucking pieces of shit. Zac Efron is also in this movie, it looks like. And for me, this looks like a wonderfully romantic movie. It celebrates showmanship. It celebrates trying to achieve, especially in the face of people not believing in you. I very rarely see trailers that excite me this much. Hug.
Hug.
William?
So I've not seen La La Land yet. I know that may kick me off the panel immediately. But this one
off
actually,
the show.
This one actually interests me. I've always been curious about this story it's Barnum before Barnum and Bailey's, but how this got started in the history around this. And I think the romanticizing and dramatization of it would be really interesting. And it seemed very carefree and benevolent, and certainly need more of that in my life. So I'm hugging.
Hug.
Katrina?
Well, I'm always down for a musical, similar to alternative media stuff. The La La Land thing is not an endorsement in my case, as Justin knows, which, again, makes me the odd one out here. The other thing that's interesting to me in this trailer is P.T. Barnum. I may be mixing him up with the Bailey fellow, but I don't think he has a reputation of being like a great guy. So this must be really romanticized and really essentialized, which I kind of think is interesting. I mean, you tend to hear, you know, a lot of stories about how this person who did this great thing was actually a terrible person. And I didn't get a whiff of that in this whole trailer. So that definitely makes me more interested as well. And I think I'm ready to forgive Hugh Jackman for that god-awful Les Miserables movie. So I will hug.
Hug.
Grant.
So I can either see this going really, really well or really, really badly. No in between one of the two. Because it's either going to be, it's amazing, it's awesome, it's romantic, like my initial impressions of the trailer, and I'm going to love it. Or it's going to be, they've completely tried to romanticize social justice, and I'm going to absolutely despise it. But I think it's going to be the first one, and I'm going to go with hug.
Hug!
Dan?
So I saw this during the previews for Justice, or in the previews before Justice League. And my first thought is this the Prestige 2? Because obviously Hugh Jackman and it seemed to sort of have a similar aesthetic. Yeah, also, like other people, I love that it's telling the story of this guy who, my general impression of him from the culture and stuff is that, yeah, like he did some kind of scumbaggy things. I forget exactly what he's accused of, but I think a lot of people around that time had entertainment was kind of shady then.
Have you been paying attention to what's been going on?
Well, I mean, in terms of like putting like weird people on display and like having really screwed up stuff for entertainment. Anyway,
you haven't convinced me there's anything different.
Okay, fair enough. Maybe it's just it was different. And I was watching. I thought like, wow, this looks awesome. And there's some lines about like, oh yeah, I'm gonna show them and make them see how great my vision is. And I thought, is this like actually a really good version of the sort of inspiring creator stands up against adversity, or am I just so used to seeing movies talk about how shitty and terrible humans are and how their plans always fail that anything that has a whiff of inspiration seems revelatory to me?
Both, because false dichotomy, bro.
Well, there's the line. So yeah, hug, absolutely. Hug.
Final trailer.
Final trailer.
Hostiles is another attempt at making a Western movie starring Christian Bale. For me, I can't really remember the plot of this. William, maybe you can follow up on me with it. This trailer seemed very meandering. I love Christian Bale. I love the fact that they're trying to make Westerns happen again, although it does make me think of Mean Girls a little bit. Gretchen, stop. You're not going to make Westerns happen. I wish they could, because I think we need to bring them back, but it's just that nothing about this is enticing to me. Tackle.
William? Yeah, I watched this trailer three times trying to figure out the plot. And now it's okay for a trailer not to, not to give away plot details, but is this kept making me think it was cowboys versus Indians, but then not. And it just seemed very confused. Like, is this a Western with a conflict? Is the conflict with nature? Is the conflict with other people? Is it just, naturalism and just conflict, not even conflict, just, random things happening? It's unclear. So while I am a Western fan, just based on this trailer, I'm going to have to tackle it.
Tackle.
You people are crazy. Like, you're seeing Justice League multiple times to figure it out. You watched this trailer three times to try to figure it out. I could barely get through this trailer once.
It's called show prep, Justin.
Same. I was just as confused about what the heck this movie is about, let alone what the plot is. And I didn't bother to watch it more than once to figure it out because I was quite confident it wouldn't give me any more information. I'm not a fan of Westerns, but what I would be a big fan of is someone making a movie that was just like, yeah, man, like a lot of native tribes were savages and did a lot of god-awful things, and fighting back against that wasn't wrong. So the beginning almost seemed like maybe it was going to say that. And then later, nothing really contradicted it, except for the text they flashed on the screen that was like, we are all hostiles. And I don't know what that means. Like, I expected it to say we are all savages or something like that, and then I would know what it means. So I if I'm not allowed to abstain, can I hug like watching a second trailer and finding out what it's actually about or something like that?
Dan, can you ad lib that?
Is that a hug?
I'll take it. Yeah. We'll put it like that.
If I had to guess, Katrina, I would say it has something to do with the interpersonal hostility thing we always talk about on the show. It's like, we are all hostiles is sort of equivalent and in the same world as we are all savages. Grant?
I'm going to say tackle. It's just, again, it's It's one of those things, like, I would wait on this movie to see what the reviews are like. Because this, I mean, this looks like it's going to be a 2.5 hour movie. Just the style it's done, I'm expecting 2.5. And if it completely rambles for 2.5 hours, I don't want to go see it. And again, you know, it could be very good and, like, this is what life was like back then. You know, these are the facts. Or it could just be, you know, we're all hostiles. So I'm going to go ahead and tackle that.
Tackle!
Dan?
So it was really interesting watching this in contrast to Greatest Showman, where in the first couple seconds I was like, all right, I have an idea of what the style is. I know what the sort of ideas behind this are. And this one, it was like, all right, so he's sitting there and talking. Okay, so now we're talking to this guy. Okay, maybe it's just like we're setting some stuff up. And then I realized, I don't know, 30 seconds in, like, I don't really know what this movie is trying to tell me, which I think is revealing in and of itself. One of the things I got from it was maybe there's a, you know, guy starts out idealistic and kind of trying to do good, and then the horrors of war bring him down and make him see that everything's kind of terrible. I don't know, maybe there's something interesting there. I was kind of worried that it would go into sort of a kind of moral equivalency type thing, but it's just hard to tell what the movie's trying to say. I'm kind of similar to Katrina, maybe with more information this could be good. I'm going to lean and give it a hug.
All right, so let's now move on to the main event that all you Midsiders are here for. It's the discussion of Justice League. We're going to start out here. We're all going to give our initial impressions of the movie. I'll start, and I'm being very slow on purpose because that is sort of my emotional approach to this movie now that I've seen it. I think the best thing that I could say is, and the most honest thing I could say to all you Midsiders is, I do not consider this a Zack Snyder movie, and I seriously doubt, unless they do release a Snyder cut on home media, but I seriously doubt there will ever be a Snyder series episode on this movie, simply because this is very clearly as little Snyder as they could use. So the movie's about 2 hours long, and if you figure that Whedon did about half an hour of reshoots, that means if Snyder's original cut was 3 hours long, they used about half of Snyder's original cut, and they used it out of order. So it's very clear they took scenes that weren't meant to be linked together, put them together. It's just, they only took it as far as, like, it was a challenge. It was like, okay, we're giving you these constraints, Joss Whedon. Make a film based upon this footage that's already shot and adding about half an hour of your own footage, half an hour and 45 minutes. Joss Whedon's a TV director. He directed a TV episode, put it together with footage that was already there, and created a 2-hour feature-length film. And it's very obvious when you watch this movie that it's two directors, two different visions, battling over what the movie will be about. So then that's the question, is what is the movie about? When I was watching this movie, because of all the time that I've spent studying Zack Snyder movies and how much I understand and love his work, I knew it was very clear he was going for hope versus fear, and to show what hope actually is and what fear actually is, and how the importance of hero worship creates a better world. So how important hero worship is in the world. But that did not come off at all. There was not any depth. And there is confirmation of that only at the very end of the movie. Obviously, spoilers, if you're still listening at this point, come on, what are you doing to yourself? But at the very end of the movie, Lois Lane gives a voiceover, which is a very nice parallel and bookend to the voiceover at the beginning of Batman versus Superman. This was all very intended. If you remember the line, Lois is the key from Batman versus Superman, when Superman is brought back from the dead in this, he is crazy and sort of evil, and Lois is the one who makes him realize who he is, remember, and be good again. So the whole Lois is the key thing was set up, and she was definitely meant to be set up as the one who's commentating, you know, as a journalist, on this world as a whole. But her speech at the end has more intellectual depth and thematic weight than the entire movie. I could go on and on, and we will talk about the specifics, but for now, that is the best summary I can give. Now I want to give everybody a little bit of time to say what their initial impressions are. I want to start with Dan. And Dan, I want to start with you because you've seen the movie twice, and you told me something very interesting, that you made a list of things you were afraid of going into this movie, and that all of them, or almost all of them, came true. And I have a feeling that your list is very similar to what I was afraid of and what many midsiders out there were afraid of. So do you want to share that list and what your impressions of the movie were?
Yeah, absolutely. Going in, having seen some of the trailers, I thought there were some really interesting points, like Batman saying, you know, Superman didn't just save people, he was a beacon to make them see the best side of themselves. I'm like, yes, cool, intellectual content, thematic depth. And then there were some things that were worrying, so I just wrote down this list. So one of them was that Whedon would have watered down the Snyderiness. And the most concrete example of that I had was putting a joke right after a serious moment, which would undercut the serious impact. This is something that I've noticed Whedon has done a lot, where you'll have some serious moment of drama, and then somebody will crack a joke, which then kind of retroactively diffuses the seriousness or the drama of that serious moment, as if to say, like, oh yeah, don't take that too seriously. Which I hate, because like I want to try to take some things seriously. Also that it would have more plain and kind of uninteresting shots. I don't know I don't have the film background to really describe it, but one of the great things about Snyder is that he has very like dramatic, interesting shots set up, and I thought Whedon is probably going to undo some of that. The second was too much focus on action for its own sake rather than as a mechanism for conveying an idea. The thing that made me worried about this was Aquaman actually in the trailers saying, yeah, or my man, where it just felt like he might as well have been saying, wee, to be joyfully going along on a roller coaster versus, again, conveying some idea that these people are fighting because they're motivated by such and such ideas, and this is a physical manifestation of the different ideas that they hold. The next one was insufficient motivation or complexity on the part of the villain. In the previous DC movies, not including, what was that one? Suicide Squad. The villains all had interesting philosophical motivations. Zod wanted to fulfill his Kantian duty and serve the greater good of Krypton, and said as much. Batman and Batman v Superman didn't trust that people could be good. Lex Luthor felt impotent and wanted to destroy the symbol of good that was a reproach against his own inferiority. Even Ares in Wonder Woman, who I think was the least complex and developed villain in the three real DC movies, wanted to show how unworthy and crappy humans were. In this, Steppenwolf just kind of wanted to take over stuff. I didn't really get any sense that there was anything more complicated than that. Next was Flash only being used for comic relief. Then Bruce Wayne changing to be just completely simplistically altruistic immediately. And finally, Wonder Woman not having any kind of meaningful conflict of values. Any like struggle between, oh, should I do this or that? That was my list of pre-movie fears going in.
Man, you nailed it. Yeah. I just watched the movie again.
Yeah. Well, Katrina, that's a perfect segue into you. And I think something that you can really talk about, because you've done some videos on this recently, is Whedon and the general approach of Hollywood coinciding with a lot of what Dan just said.
Right. Yeah. So it's kind of funny to me that I'm here as the Whedon expert, considering that my experience as a Joss Whedon fan has just descended into like perpetual cringe mode. Not just.
Well, I will interrupt a little bit. I do think he's gotten worse because I was a fan of his stuff too.
Yeah, no, well, because here's the thing, right? So, for example, what Dan just described about not letting a serious moment lie, which was one of my biggest problems with this movie, and one of my biggest problems with Joss Whedon as a writer long term, right? Having to crack a joke at exactly the moment when you should just let it sit there and let the impact of this massive moment just sink in. Right? Like the kind of person who, this is a trick you use in sales and in the business world, right? It's like you just sit there silently and people can't handle it, or it, certain types of people can't handle it, which is most people. And Joss Whedon is 100% that guy, right? If you were in a meeting with him and, you know, you wanted to put him in his place, like just sit there quietly and don't say anything because he will start running his mouth because he can't handle just a moment of stillness. And that played very differently in a show like Buffy, where it's about kids, right? Like where they're teenagers, young adults, whatever. And they're trying to deal, like the humor is how they're dealing with the weightiness, or rather kind of not dealing with it, but like it's the best they can do because they're in this really unusual circumstance. But now he's making movies and stories about adults and he hasn't grown up. The writing hasn't grown up. And this is, I mean, it's like, come on, we're talking, like, it's not like this is the first time that any of these people have done this, right? Like Aquaman's people have literally faced the same threat before. So have Wonder Woman's. Superman just previously died in order to save the world against a big threat. And Batman's been doing this forever and he's old and jaded. So why would they need, you know, like the Flash probably maybe needs a little like psychological break from the weight because it's new to him. Maybe Cyborg does a little bit, but they had Superman make a dumb joke like after the most important thing that happened in the movie, right? That was like a huge, I mean, that was huge for him, right? He like literally just came back to life and promises Lois that he's not going to do it again and then maybe almost dies, right? And it's like, yeah, that's exactly when that character would make a joke. Basically everything that came out of Superman's mouth didn't make any sense the whole movie. I don't know if I was giving you what you wanted there, but anyway.
You gave me exactly what you wanted to say, which is exactly what I want here. I want raw opinions, which is perfect transition into William. William expressed to me personally that you enjoyed this movie off air. So do you want to talk about your impressions, William?
Yeah, I liked the movie. I did not. I tried to come in with neutral to low expectations because I was expecting basically a Marvel movie with Snyder footage, and it sounds like some of you guys feel that the movie was that way, but I didn't go in looking for that. I went in looking for kind of neutral, saying, well, if this at least discusses ideas and attempts at a theme, then, you know, maybe it'll be enjoyable, and I enjoyed it. There's certainly, like, just looking at it as a movie, there's certainly some criticisms I understand and don't understand just as a movie, not as a Snyder film. I know a lot of people kind of panned the CGI. I wasn't at all distracted by any of the effects. The fight scenes seemed well paced, not as well paced as and choreographed as others. There just seemed to me, and I know Justin, we had talked about this after I saw the movie, there seemed to me, just watching it as a movie, you know, again, not looking at it, not analyzing it as a Snyder film, to be a lot missing, a lot of things that were just not there, a lot of development or transition that was just not there. And I think, Justin, when we talked, I told you, I was like, I was a little more optimistic. I was like, oh, this is just like every other DC film where I'll have to wait till the Blu-ray come out on iTunes for me to see the actual movie. This is a great trailer for the actual Justice League movie that'll come out in 6 months. So that's my impression.
I wish I had that much hope, which is ironic after seeing this movie that I lack hope completely. But I do wonder if Whedon was doing that intentionally, but I don't think he was. I just think he's a fuck. But I do lack hope that because Whedon took over in March. So I don't know if there's footage to do a Snyder cut, because the irony here is that they doubled down on what they did on Batman versus Superman, which is they cut the shit out of the theatrical cut. When I left the theater for Batman versus Superman, I had to make a lot of excuses for the movie. I was like, oh, there are three threads here, Lex, Batman, and Superman, and they eventually collide. But when I watched the Ultimate Edition, I was like, oh, all the connective tissue is back. And when I watched Justice League, like, that is my main feeling. I have a feeling of incompleteness. I'm not angry. Maybe I should be. Maybe I should be like Dominique and push statues downstairs, but I don't feel the need to do that. I just feel incomplete. Like, I didn't see everything there was to see, and I didn't see the movie. I just saw something called Justice League, which was jumping all over the place, where, you know, 1 minute Aquaman's out, then he's in. 1 minute we're in this place. Now we're fighting Steppenwolf. Like, it was just very, very jumpy. But we still have one person to follow up with. And I think Grant has a really interesting perspective. As I said earlier, Grant, you've seen Wonder Woman 20 times. But you also expressed to us pre-show that you've seen Justice League twice and you liked it a lot less the second time.
Yeah. You know, first time I went through and I was just, oh, Wonder Woman's back on screen, totally enamored. I was like, yes, this is awesome. And kind of just getting a feel for what happens. So last night when I saw it, and I just kept track of, like, okay, what happens in each scene? And the biggest thing, I mean, it kind of feels like we could have Snyder come along. Like, we're just waiting for the stick of dynamite to blow the thing to pieces. Because the biggest question I had through a lot of it was, like, why? You know, like, with a lot of, like, the fight scenes, you know, why? Like, contrast this, you know, I watched Man of Steel yesterday. And, spoilers for any of you who, if you've not seen that yet, you know, Russell Crowe at the beginning is a great example. Every single thing that he does is a continuing answer to, is my son worth it? Is this battle worth it? You know, every challenge is harder and it builds. Whereas in this, I was like, why are you having a fight scene here? Well, you know, what is this building to? The same thing with a lot of the symbolism that was kind of scattered throughout. You know, like, for me, Wonder Woman was really good at having solid symbolism. You know, it's about, are you motivated by values? Are you motivated by destruction? Everything in it was hinting at that. Whereas this was, you know, they had these boxes that are their power incarnate. And then there's a little bit thrown in of, like, Steppenwolf being like, you know, you will learn to love me when you learn that power is, like, the only truth. And then, like, random bits of kind of the hope and truth. And just, like, it felt like the symbolism was just, like, magic buzzwords. And, oh, if we throw some magic buzzwords in here, it'll have the cool quality that symbolism gives it. You know, it was like, why are you including these things? Just as a side note, I couldn't help but get past, I don't know if the rest of you guys made this connection, but the Beast in the new Beauty and the Beast, Steppenwolf's facial expressions were almost exactly the same the entire time.
Saw that,
so, like, yeah, and once I realized that, I was like, the villain was already wooden, and the fact that he was CGI, it wasn't like, oh, the CGI is bad. It was like, I'm not as horrified by this, just because of the way it was done. And then once I saw that, I was like, I can't anymore. It doesn't work.
Well, I think part of what you're talking about is a result of what you said with the lack of the why. You're forced to only focus on the visuals, and you start to see these things if there are no ideas motivating it. This is similar to what Dan said in his opening, and this is sort of where I want to go next, is talk about sort of the characters and how romanticism, well done, is actually better for the characters. So, Dan, you talked about something similar when you talked about Aquaman. And you talked about this whole my man and this all right thing.
Yeah.
To me, that is the most appealing thing about Aquaman in this movie. And I think those scenes where, like, he's caught by Cyborg and says my man, and, like, he jumps onto the craft or the Batman's craft, like, I think those are Snyder's scenes. And I think what that's meant to show is that Aquaman just has a joy for life and a joy for fighting. But because he was not loved growing up, especially by his mother. In the backstory that was cut, he was rejected by his mother, right? There was a whole scene with Willem Dafoe, and it was about how he's a halfling and was forced to live with humans because his mother rejected him. I believe that was even in the scene with Mera, correct? She talked about that?
Right. I don't think they explicitly mentioned that he was a halfling, but he was dropped off. His mother left him at his father's place, and so he grew up with humans, is what came through in the movie.
Right, so he was essentially rejected by both, because as we saw with Superman, he couldn't really, in Man of Steel, he couldn't really get along with humans because he is Superman. He is this man of ability, of more ability than everyone else. And he was also, you know, he had the human side to him. It's the same thing here with Aquaman. So we see how Aquaman's story was meant to echo Wonder Woman's story in Wonder Woman and Superman's story in Man of Steel. And that was completely gutted from it. And we lose the impact behind, like you said, the action. We lose the impact behind it because there is nothing there. We don't understand why he's saying my man and how he was depressed and holding himself down before he met the Justice League and other people who were similar to him. And I think that's similar to what you guys are talking about with Steppenwolf. He loses all of his, you know, when we look at Zod, he was intimidating. He was scary as a villain. And you lose that intimidation and you lose the feeling of the threat for Steppenwolf because he doesn't have that depth. I mean, isn't this one of the critiques of Marvel villains? So does anyone else get the impression that the characters could have been more and should have been more?
Yeah.
Pretty much
all of them, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the main thing I told you, Justin, after I watched it was Batman was completely torn apart, clearly between the beginning and the end of the movie, right? As far as I'm concerned, the actual movie that Snyder set out to make had Batman... I mean, it is an ensemble and everything like that. But insofar as someone is a main character, Batman is the main character because he's the one who has a redemption arc to follow after the prior movie, in trying to kind of fix things after Superman's death and trying to bring himself from the local Gotham guy to the global protector guy now that Superman can't fill that role anymore and bring all these people together and basically figure out how a guy with no powers fits into this situation. And you always have to answer that question when you're dealing with ensembles where there are non-powered people, right? Like, why are they there? And there's a really, really good answer that was already in the first half of the movie, which is that Batman is an incredibly strong leader. And you see that in a number of scenes early on. And then Whedon, we know this is a Whedon scene, threw that all away because he wanted to throw a random bone to a woman, you know, his bone, really, to psychologize a little bit here. But he decided for some reason Batman needs to tell Wonder Woman that she's supposed to be the leader. And why? Reasons. Like, no good reason, right? It's literally just like, we're going to say that Wonder Woman should be the leader. And what is she going to do to be a leader? She's going to tell everyone to go save Batman. And then after that, Batman goes right back to being the leader.
That scene where they go to save Batman.
I hadn't put that together.
This is why Katrina.
I like Batman. That's the other thing. I like Batman, and I don't get distracted by pretty women.
Well, and Snyder loves Batman too, and doesn't get distracted by pretty women either. I know you might disagree with that, Katrina, but
it's not pretty. It's not pretty women. That's not his issue with women.
Well, we saw the mother thing throughout this movie, and we can talk about that in a minute. I do think that was intentional, but let's sidebar that for a second. The scene where they all go back to save Batman in the village outside Chernobyl, that was clearly intended in Snyder's version to be the moment the team finally comes together around Batman as the hero and finally is able to fight. And then they fight their way into Steppenwolf, and then they can't fight Steppenwolf, so Superman has to come in and be the final piece that makes it so they can beat Steppenwolf. That was what that moment was supposed to mean. Instead, it was completely undercut by this whole Wonder Woman edit. And that's something I want to ask you about, and I already know, when William, you can say why you disagree, but I already know how William feels, but I want to see how you feel, Katrina. I think that he went even worse, Whedon, where not only did he do this with Wonder Woman, but he had her talking shit about the rest of the team. One of the worst lines in the entire movie for me was, after they break the boxes apart, there's a big explosion. So Cyborg and Superman pull these three boxes apart to destroy the Unity, which, by the way, side comment, Snyder showing how bringing everything together and homogenizing and Unity is bad in favor of individualism. That was lost in the movie.
Yeah.
Intentional on Snyder's part. But that's why it was called the Unity. But so it explodes, and Cyborg goes back one way, and Superman falls back the other way, and they're on their backs, and they start laughing. This is clearly a response to everyone saying these superheroes don't have fun. And so they're having fun, and they're doing what everyone says. And then fucking Whedon has to have a fucking derisive comment from Wonder Woman going, I work with children. To me, this is the view that women have of men in our society. It's the idea that men are just children that women have to take care of. And I really think that that was Whedon's intent in putting it in there. Katrina?
I mean, I don't even know if he has that much intent or just like this knee-jerk reflex at this point. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it also shows how delusional he is about what constitutes a leader, right? Because a leader would never, ever say that. I mean, just watch any war movie, right? And you always have the scene where the good leader like gets everyone drunk or something like that, right? Or gives them the break that they need. They had it in Wonder Woman, right? Like they have that dancing scene. I mean, she acted more like a leader in the Wonder Woman movie than she did in this. It's like, and she acted more human, which is ironic because they make a comment, and I think this might have been a Snyder line, or at least I think it's a good line, where Batman says that Wonder Woman is more human than he is. And I think that is connected.
He said about Superman.
It was Superman.
He said about Superman. Oh, you're right. He did say about Superman. Sorry, I thought he said about Wonder Woman, but you're right. So I'm positive that that was a Snyder line. Or
I'm not
would
sure
have been
it is
similar.
Because I believe that anything on the plane was a
that's
reshoot
true.
By Whedon. I don't think that's
but it could have been a reshoot and it could have still kept the same lines, if that makes sense. Do you know what I mean?
That's fair.
See Snyder putting in because that's consistent with the story in the prior movie and the movie before that, right? About like
that Superman was, especially Batman versus Superman. Superman was more human than
Batman. So I think that that is a perfectly fine that part makes sense, but being a leader isn't like, oh, I'm the most human, I'm the most sensitive, or I'm the most whatever that means. That's completely separate, right? And to me, Whedon kind of mashes up those two things where he's just like, oh, it's the same thing as like, oh, we want women in all these roles and power in society just because reasons, right? I mean, it's like, how do you explain it? It's like, it's not necessarily fun to be a leader, right? Like, it doesn't mean that you're better than other people. It's just a role out of a bigger group, and every part of that group is important. And with a group movie, that's especially important to recognize. So when you start to view like, oh, this leader position is the most important, therefore I need to toss it to a woman or I need to toss it to a minority or whatever, you're not getting it. Like, you're not getting how human interactions work and what makes people happy, right? Like, people are happy when they're doing the thing that's best suited to them. And if Wonder Woman is best suited to be sort of the moral voice of the team, then she shouldn't be the leader. And Whedon has gotten that right in other shows, like in Firefly. So it's pretty frustrating to see it now.
I do think there is a little bit of the studio wanting to make Wonder Woman the leader because they believe that was their best movie. It was certainly the most commercially successful. So I do think there's a little bit of Whedon lining up with the studio's marketing perspective. So I do want to, you know, modulate that a little bit. But I also want to throw it to William and Grant here, and we'll go William, then Grant, because Grant here is our Wonder Woman expert. So, Grant, when it's your turn after William, I want to hear what you think about Wonder Woman as a character in the Wonder Woman movie versus Justice League. But, William, go ahead. I know you disagree on this line from Wonder Woman.
Well, I wouldn't say I disagree. I certainly understand what you guys are seeing there, but I think I didn't come in with as much suspicion. So like when I heard that line, my reaction wasn't like, oh, this is an attack on what they experienced or attack on masculinity or I didn't, that wasn't my first reaction. My first reaction was like, oh, of course, she's just that old. Like everyone seems like children to her. That was just my reaction to that. And I just took it at the surface value, but I definitely see what you guys are saying about that.
Don't you think that that's what Whedon trades in, though, is that he trades in this idea of, of course, it's only because she's really old. There's no other hidden agenda behind it. But that's what he masks his agenda behind.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think if I watch it a second time, which, by the way, I don't plan on doing unless there's an extended cut, then I think my reactions might be a lot more in line with what some of you guys are pointing out, especially as other folks in the panel here have said, as far as watching a second time, kind of being like a little less thrilled with it.
Yeah, and there are several Whedon lines throughout it that I found really, really bad. The thirsty line, to have Martha say that she's thirsty, or to say that Lois is thirsty, like, are you kidding me? Like, these are like serious characters. Like, the relationship between Clark and his mother has been important over two lines and over two movies. And now you're turning her into this crazy old woman who doesn't understand slang. And then Lois has been like this super important character, and like you're gonna like lower her down by calling her thirsty, like in the general culture where the, of crassness. That one was really bad. And then the racial line they added, which does what Katrina says. So at the end, Snyder had this epic, awesome hero shot with the entire league, and they have this fist bump between Flash and Cyborg in that awesome hero shot by Snyder, because they're supposed to, you know, be bonded, and they're going to be in movies together later on, and they're the two young guys who are coming to terms with their powers. And then Whedon literally wrote an entire scene of digging up Superman's grave with a racial joke in there to undercut that hero thing at the end. It's disgusting. But, Grant, I want to know what you think about Wonder Woman as a character in the Wonder Woman movie versus Justice League.
Yeah, so in Wonder Woman, in the movie, it was 1,000 times better than I think in Justice League. And, you know, for me, I look at, okay, what about Wonder Woman in Wonder Woman appeals to me? You know, she's strong. And that's kind of the general, everyone's like, oh, she's so strong, like, she's so there. But specifically, she's morally and mentally strong. You know, she is, this is who I am, this is what I think, and goddammit, I'm gonna go do it. And she does. And we miss a lot of that in Justice League. Like, I mean, again, with the plane scene, and it's been more of a theme through the Snyder movies that I don't know that I care for as much, where they made Wonder Woman out to have emotional and psychological baggage. Like, she's got problems. Like, the thing I loved about Wonder Woman the movie was that Wonder Woman, she's psychologically, she's healthy. She's there. She's got it. You know, she's not like an Iron Man who's got all of his neuroticism, or, you know, Batman who's got his past demons. Like, she's whole. And I think they cut out a lot of that in this movie. Like, that scene where it was like, oh, yeah, you know, I've got all of this baggage from Steve. I mean, it makes sense, but for what the character stands for, I don't like having it there. And I think going to like what Dan said, I mean, she's just kind of there in this movie. Like, she's there because she's part of the team, and she has to be part of the team. You know, there wasn't really a Wonder Woman line in this thing. It felt like maybe it was kind of hinted at with, like, opening up a bit towards Victor and learning to unshut herself off from the world. But it felt contrived and forced, and honestly, the whole thing, it felt like, you know how, like, companies will do those team building activities? Like, if you take, like, an example from, like, The Office, oh, we'll have team building activities. This movie felt a lot like a team building activity. Stepping where everything is just
team building activity. Let's
yeah, exactly. He's the unconvincing, why are we battling this? Because this is a pointless challenge to solve. Team building activity that is there specifically so we can bring the team back together. You know, like, because all the focus in it is, you see the shots of, oh, well, let's see these guys digging up this grave and they're kind of bonding. Let's see these guys over here with my man and they're like having a cool bro moment. Like, it's all about let's see the team bond. And Steppenwolf is just like a sit-in for that. And I think a lot of the way that Wonder Woman's character came off was just, she's just here to be built in as part of the team. Because I think that's how a lot of the movie came off, is just, it needs to be built in as part of a team. The first scene with her, I like the first scene a lot. And I'm wondering if that's a Snyder scene instead.
Because everything the entire in that first is portion Snyder of the movie. When she's fighting the terrorist, you can definitely tell it's Snyder, because that was one of the most thematic lines in the movie, where it's the idea that the modern world is no good anymore, and the only
the holy
solution
fear of the Dark Age.
Yeah, is to go back to the Dark Age. Like, that's the only solution. I mean, to go objectivist for a second, isn't that fucking the novella, what's it called? I'm blanking right
Anthem?
Now. Anthem. Isn't that Anthem? The idea that we will necessarily go backwards, return of the primitive?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, tell me Snyder's not versed in objectivism when he has a line like that in his movie.
Or one I noticed
I would be very surprised.
They referred to Superman as, what was it? The motor of the world that is now stopped.
Yeah. I'm like, he didn't say, motor of the world. Yeah. He said engine, but I thought that was interesting because it reminded me that there's world engine in Man of Steel. I'm not sure if there was something in the last, in Batman versus Superman, but there were a couple of other things that they referred to as various engines of the world. The mother boxes are effectively another type of world engine. Right. So I thought it was really interesting that they had this setup, and it was the closest thing to a theme that I could grab onto, that there are basically two possible motors for the world, and one of them runs backwards and one of them runs forward.
You guys are like going to make me cry because this is so good.
But it wasn't in there. Yeah. I mean, it's barely in there. It's so frustrating.
But it's in there for us because we understand Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman and what they were going for. And Grant, you can start out this time, but I'm going to give a little bit of a preamble. If you look at the way these three movies built, they built in such a brilliant way. It starts out with Man of Steel, which is the man of ability trying to find his place in the world and the fear of being rejected by it and how to exist and the fact that he has to choose to live in this world. And then you go forward to Batman versus Superman, which is literally the man of ability being rejected by the world and how he responds to that and what the proper way of dealing with the man ability and how he lives in the world is, and just how that's motivated by this hatred of the good that exists in the world. And then that was clearly intended to build again in Justice League, where Justice League was going to be about fear and how fear is what leads to hating the man of ability. But really, as you were just saying, Katrina, the man of ability, hope, and that's how Snyder is concretizing that. He's concretizing it in the idea of hope. Hope is the engine of the world and what keeps the world going. And that was Lois's speech at the end. That was clearly the three movie arc he was going for. Is that what you're talking about, Grant, when you said you want to talk about how this fits into the world of the first two?
Yeah, like the storyline, the theme, the way the movies are done, that whole kind of thing. I mean, because... Yeah, I really like the way you summarize those, because I just saw Man of Steel, Batman vs. Superman yesterday, so still getting my thoughts on those. But this did seem very much like, you know, Batman vs. Superman was letting the individual run free has consequences. And are we willing to accept those consequences? No, we're going to nuke him. And then they see what happens to the world without Superman, and they realize, oh, well, shit, we kind of screwed that one up. And it's about, you know, rediscovering this hope. You know, okay, how do we rediscover this? And they did a good job at the beginning with lining it up with our world today. You know, there were a lot of, the beginning was the exact same style that Man of Steel and Batman vs. Superman had, like, just in terms of the way it felt.
Except for the dumb found footage bit.
Yeah. Where they didn't even answer the question.
Yeah.
Nope.
That found footage put such a sour taste in my mouth. I was sitting there and I go, this doesn't even fucking work. Like, this doesn't even make any sense. What does this have to do with anything? I literally, like, I just had to forget about it to watch the movie.
You set up this important, meaningful question in the, you know, literally the first scene of the movie. And not only does he cut out what Superman's answer is, but, like, at no point in the movie did they ever answer what is Superman's favorite thing about Earth.
They don't even allude to it. It's just like let's deliberately fly in the face of the question why and just say nah.
As if it's unimportant. That that's Whedon not understanding the first two movies, because in the first movie it's clearly established, and Grant, this is what you're hinting at, that individualism is the value of Earth, and that's why Superman chooses humans over Krypton, because Zod is wanting to create this collectivist society, collectivist fascist society, whereas humans, you have choice and you can be whoever you want and you can choose to be a force for good in this world. And then in the second one, it's clearly established that Lois is his other favorite thing about the world. You know, this is my world, you are my world. So I would argue Whedon even putting that in there shows that he doesn't fundamentally understand the two movies that came before it.
Yeah.
He doesn't seem like he gets it, I think, at all. He gets part of it because, well, he gets that the third movie, and maybe he doesn't even get this, and it just worked out. But he gets that the beginning of the third movie is where our world is at. You know, you see, I tried, everybody knows things are going south. You know, the evil is on the rise. You see those guys getting out of the van, strong, confident. Like, evil has the moral certainty. The good just doesn't. You know, Batman doesn't even recognize this world. Like, I was watching that, and the way they were describing some of these things, it was like, yeah, this reflects the way that I feel about things right now.
Snyder's,
you know, it reflects the kind of vibe that
I get. That montage was vintage Snyder. I mean, if you look at that montage and compare it to the opening credits for Watchmen, it's almost the same thing.
It felt very Snyder. It was like, this sets the right tone. This sets the right mood. Like, I really like this and where this is going. And then they just didn't. They didn't follow up on that.
If anything, I would argue that Whedon does understand it, but he understands it the way, like, Tui understands Rourke. He understands it just well enough to push back against it and destroy it, which is why this movie is, like, the Cortland of movies. It's
exactly. It literally, why?
I wanted that to be your final thought, Katrina.
Sorry.
You blew your load too early.
I'm sorry.
We're an hour in.
So I wanted to... One thing that really stuck out to me was the Superman resurrection scene, and this is something that, like, particularly bothered me right after seeing it the first time, was, you know, so they resurrect Superman, he pops out, and then he starts fighting them, and I thought, okay, why is Superman fighting them? And I thought there are two possible motivations that I could come up with. The first is that he's basically feral. He's, you know, just came back from the dead, he doesn't have conscious faculty, he's, you know, totally crazy, non-rational, just lashing out randomly. The second is that he's had some kind of shift in his morality or his, you know, thinking or his, you know, evaluation of whatever. And so when I was watching it, especially for the second time, I was looking like, what evidence can I find of one of those views or the other? And in the beginning, it looks like he's very much in the feral mode, where he's kind of, like, twitching a little bit and, like, seems unsure about, like, who these people are, what his powers are, and doesn't really understand stuff. But as soon as he starts talking, that destroys the ability to understand it as the feral motivation, because he's, you know, he talks to Batman, and he says, oh, like, I remember you, and he says the, you know, do you bleed line, and
guess who wrote all of those lines?
Yeah, it was all Whedon. So there was a forum.
He doesn't
post
even understand the basic plot mechanics that were in the movie that he was hacking to death.
Yeah,
sorry.
So there was a forum post by somebody who claimed to have worked on the movie and had a breakdown of which parts were Whedon, which parts were Snyder. The source for that is some guy on a forum who seemed to talk authoritatively, so, you know, take that with as much salt as you feel is appropriate. But he said everything where Superman was talking in that scene was Whedon. And I thought, that makes complete sense, because if it's, you know, one, if it's a moral shift, why does seeing Lois snap him out of it? He doesn't seem to have any change.
See, that would make more sense to me than the feral.
Well, if he sees Lois, if he's feral and he sees Lois, and he's like, oh my god, now I, you know, remember what my values are, and then it, you know, completely snaps him back to being normal.
There you go. That's what I was just going to say. I'm going to say, I'm going to prove why I'm the host of this. I'm going to assert my value, and I'm going to say, false dichotomy, bro. Mm. I think it's both feral and the Lois thing, because this was shown all the way back to the Vision in Batman versus Superman, where Superman was evil without Lois. And why was he evil? Because what had he lost? He had lost his hope. So the Superman who comes back is a Superman without hope. So he is both feral and a shift in morality, because what is the ultimate shift in morality? When you become anti-life, basically, you basically are nothing more than a wild animal looking to destroy. And what is Superman when he comes back and is fighting everyone? He is just looking to destroy them, because he has lost his hope. And that is why, quote, Lois is the key. And that is why Bruce knows that she is ultimately the way to save Superman, and she is the contingency plan. That is clearly all Snyder, and that is clearly what was intended. But as Katrina points out, Whedon did not get that, and he had to go explainy with his dialogue.
Well, and here's the other thing. He explains it even before the scene happens. So this is one of the few times where things would have been more clear with less explanation. There was a major problem that he added this whole big argument about whether or not they should resurrect Superman, because they're making explicit these questions like, maybe he won't be the same person, maybe he'll lose his soul, maybe this, maybe that, whatever. And then we have the scene, he starts that crazy, and we never answer the question of why, because of the way they set it up. If they had never had that argument, if they were just like, we need Superman, you know, end of story, you know, we don't have Green Lantern, we don't have all these other people we needed last time to defeat Steppenwolf, we're going to resurrect him, and then he was feral, no one would have questions about it, because it's like, yeah, that's what you expect to happen, right? That's every resurrection story ever. Like, the thing that comes back is, like, not the same, and you have to reorient it, and it would make perfect sense that Lois helped him reorient, and it all would have played just fine. But instead, Whedon likes to have, he likes to have his characters argue, right? He likes to have the team have these discussions where, no,
well,
where nothing happened.
Katrina.
And and he writes those scenes pretty well for what they are, but they don't fit in this type of movie. They don't fit in this, even in the DC universe. So it was a waste of time. It was a waste of time, and it made things more confusing instead of more clear.
Right, and that's what I'm talking to you. That's what I've told you when, you know, privately you were like, what confused you about this movie? That's why I felt the whole thing was confused. It jumps around. Like, now Superman's being resurrected. Now there's Lois. Now Martha's showing up. Oh, wait, now we're back in Russia fighting. Like, now we have this random civilians in here to show that DC heroes can save civilians, too. Like, yeah. It was just all over the place.
Oh, and
that
one pissed me off, too, because that led to one of the old, like, one of the things I like in the Snyder movies is there aren't a lot of, like, what I would call errors. There weren't in the Nolan movies either, right? In Marvel, I expect a lot more hand-wavy, like, oh, all of a sudden this hero who, like, we previously established couldn't do this thing is doing this thing because it's convenient for the plot. In that scene rescuing civilians, Superman catches up to the Flash. That doesn't make any sense. They've already established earlier in a really good fight scene between the Flash and Superman, right, that Superman is slightly slower than the Flash. He has always been slightly slower than the Flash. Everybody knows this, which is also why the race scene at the end was dumb. Even though the Flash was new and this was his first time racing Superman, we already knew from that fight scene that the Flash is faster. And then they have him, like in order to catch up, you have to be, like, not just a little faster, like, a lot faster. It doesn't make any sense. And it was, and now we know that
also,
that was added, too.
Right, and that's why also the fucking scene in the mid-credits is pointless even within the movie that exists. You've already shown Superman is faster than Flash in that scene. Flash would know it by being like, shit, he just caught up with me, yet they're still going to race at the end because he wants to do this fucking fanboy fantasy of, oh, wow, I'm writing a movie with Superman and Flash, so I'm going to do the whole what if they race scene.
No, that was like, that was from a cartoon a while back. They had a race.
So it's even fucking worse. It's just fanboy wank. It's just... Ugh. Okay, so... This has been going on pretty long, and I'm sure we could all say lots of things about this. So basically what I want to do now is everybody just have their final thoughts. We'll just run down in the order we've been doing it with. Dan, go ahead, give your final thoughts.
I came out of it the first time just depressed at what I had seen, worrying that I had missed something, and... went back and saw it again immediately afterwards and was like, nope, didn't miss anything. It's just depressing that something that seems like it could have had potential was ruined. I'm now wondering, like, could I have... Is there a... Without Whedon, would it have been a good movie? And that's the new game that I'm playing. So...
Hail Snydra.
Hail Snydra. Yeah, I just... it feels like watching a murder of a movie.
Katrina?
Well, first off, I want to thank you, Justin, for concretizing this arc across three movies, because it further justifies my point that Batman is the secret main character, because it's important
100%.
That Batman, as the human, realizes that he can take on the role that Superman played in terms of hope, and that it's not all actually about this alien creature, but it's an internal experience for all humans everywhere.
Yes, that's the entire point of the line, men are still good. That's the entire point of that line. Like, that is why that's such a brilliant line. Like, I you don't understand. I quote that line to myself. Like, when I get really upset and I'm like, this world is fucked, I just go, men are still good.
Right. Well, thank you for connecting those dots for me, although I like to think I would have gotten there eventually, mulling it over a few more days. And secondly, it ties back to a big, big concern that I've had for the industry for a long time, which is the people at Warner Brothers making these movies don't understand them at all. They know the Christopher Nolan Batman movies made money. My guess is Snyder got in because Christopher Nolan was like, hey, you guys should use this guy. And they're like,
yeah, they're
okay.
Friends, apparently.
Yeah, and the studio exec said okay based on that, but they don't get it. And now they see Marvel making money hand over fist and Disney doing well, and all their whole instinct is just to go copy them. Which is exactly what happens when your company doesn't have a vision and a direction and a coherent philosophy for who you are, like, what is your identity? Well, my identity is whatever makes the most money, which is always going to lead you off in the wrong direction.
Right. And that led to a lot of them buying into this anti-Snyder hype in the media.
Correct.
And they basically, in Batman versus Superman and Justice League, they've basically been trying to undercut Snyder's vision. And then there's a whole thing to talk about here that it's probably not suitable for this show, but there's a lot I have to wonder about Geoff Johns and his politicizing, and all of a sudden he snaked his way in here and taken over what was originally supposed to be Snyder's role as the leader of the DCEU.
Right, yeah, we had exactly the same thing happening on DC Comics. I mean, DC Comics have been SJW before Marvel, to be fair, but they hired Joss Whedon to take over for Zack Snyder, and they just hired Brian Michael Bendis on the comic book side, who is the Whedon of comics. And so everyone's basically doubling down and heading in exactly the same direction, which means that the industry is literally starving for someone to do something different. And I'm really glad that there are projects out there like Alt Hero and some other ones that are going to fill that gap. But it's going to be a long time before we see that on a silver screen and giving heroes the movies they deserve.
Yeah, and Geoff Johns snaked his way into DC Comics too, and he's even writing that Doomsday Clock arc, which is all about... It's basically the inverse Batman versus Superman. It's all about Dr. Manhattan and Superman and their role in the world. So Johns definitely knows what he's doing in regards to countering Snyder and Snyder's take on Watchmen and the whole Superman mythos. William?
Yeah, I wanted to touch just briefly as we wrap up, you know, talk about the critical reaction. It's pretty much across the board among critics on Rotten Tomatoes, it's negative. Across audience, though, fairly positive. But the thing that unites them both is everyone sees this as, if you're a critic, as a failed attempt. If you're an audience, as a positive, maybe semi-successful attempt to bring the DC universe to be more like the Marvel universe. And I definitely, if that's the takeaway from this, that the studio, that WB sees, then they're getting the wrong message.
It's a great final thought. Grant?
So I would say there are really two things. The first is we are right now at the very beginning of this movie in terms of real life. Like, there is no hope. This is effectively shot all hope. Like, the movie that's supposed to be about bringing back hope has left this whole project feeling pretty hopeless. And, you know, I think they need to look at Wonder Woman and ask themselves, why did Wonder Woman succeed? You know, and I think Wonder Woman succeeded because it was largely philosophical. You know, they made this attempt to bring back hope in this movie, and they didn't understand what hope depends on or what will bring it back. You know, it ended with, hey, just... you're not alone. There are these people here. And so you can feel hopeful. And it felt entirely unconvincing to me. And so I think that they need to ask, you know, why did Wonder Woman succeed? And they need to bring things in a more philosophical direction. Because as it is right now, they're going very anti-philosophical. Just why in that direction? And I think it's killing the whole thing.
I think all of your thoughts are very strong as final close-up thoughts, everyone. I want to follow up with what Grant and William said. When you watch art, you have a choice. And it's a choice that affects your entire life. And it's something that really drives the show, drives this show, Welcome to the Midside. It drives me as an analyst of art, and it drives me as an artist myself. And the choices do you want to use art as an escape? Do you want to use it as an evasion where you go and you have quips and you just say, oh, it's just entertainment? Or do you want to use it as fuel for your soul, as inspiration? And your choice is to demand more or not. And that's really what this boils down to. Do you want this depth that Grant is talking about? Do you want it to degenerate to Marvel like William is talking about? Or, you know, well, those were the or, but, or it's just what do you demand from your entertainment? And right now we're sitting on a precipice where there are very few people, very few artists, very few films, very few TV shows, any style of art that has this depth. And we have just seen the culture war over the past 4 or so years destroy Justice League and what it could have been. And we could have had an amazing trilogy. Instead, all we're left with is 2 really good movies and 1 denouement that we may never see. We can hope for the Snyder Cut. As I said before, I don't have much hope for it. But this is what happens when you don't demand more. You see Sucker Punch as merely objectifying women when it's actually about completely the opposite. It is your choice and it will improve your life. And I will end by saying that was one of my favorite scenes in the movie, and it was clearly a Snyder scene where Wonder Woman is talking to Cyborg and she's saying, you have these powers, you have these gifts, you can choose what to do with them. And he says, well, I don't want to do anything with them. And she says, well, that's not good enough. And he thinks she's arguing altruism. This is intentional. He thinks she's arguing that you have to do this for the world. You have a gift. You have to use it to protect the world. He's like, well, I don't want to. And she says to him, that's not good enough for you. It was a brilliant scene. And that's what I want everyone to take away. What is good enough for you in arts and entertainment? Are you okay with what Justice League ended up being? Or do you want more in what it could have been? I want to thank everyone for coming on the show. I think you all added something unique and all had very, very great thoughts. And you know what? Me personally, I feel like the book is closed on Justice League unless there's a Snyder cut. So, Dan, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Katrina, enjoyable as always.
My pleasure.
Grant, I'm really glad you reached out and you shared your expertise. I think we might have you on the show a little bit more now.
That would be awesome. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
All right, and William, stick around for a second. We got to put a button on this episode.
All right.
Now that our discussion is over and I've said goodbye to our panel, it's time to bring Daniel back into the fold to say bye to all of you Midsiders. Daniel, welcome back.
What an enlightening discussion that I did not hear and will never listen to.
You may want to after you see the movie, but that's a whole other thing. What did you learn though earlier in this episode?
I learned that I'm completely dispensable to this show, and that basically I bring nothing to the table, and you could have a monkey do my job.
Except for the whole news section, I don't know how you took that away at all. That is you really internalized those news stories, didn't you?
That's right. That's right. I'm a racist fuck, and I don't deserve to be on this show.
William, what did you learn?
I learned that my future children cannot be friends with white people because white people do not exist.
Good lesson. I like it. Justin, what did you learn?
I've learned that I really want the culture wars to literally degenerate into a Muppet Show style war in DC and just every major city. I just want cannons to start coming out of buildings and shooting chickens at each other.
It's coming soon. Culture War, by the way, is the sequel to Marvel's Civil War. So that should be entertaining. Anyway, if you were entertained by this show and or repulsed, why don't you tell us on social media the world where reality doesn't exist? You can tell us at The Midside everywhere on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat. Wherever goods are sold. You can also go to the website, themidside.com/podcast, where you can listen to every single episode of Welcome to the Midside from the past. You can also buy a shirt at themidside.com/store, get your false dichotomy bro t-shirt and classic logo.
Classic!
It's classic. It's like classic Coke. And I don't mean Coca-Cola, I mean literally cocaine. What?
It's not like Vlasic pickles.
It's not Vlasic. No, it's classic. Get your letters right. And then there's, of course, iTunes, Google Play, where you can subscribe to the podcast, get it delivered to whatever device it is that you listen to this godforsaken show on automatically. And while you're there subscribing, you can leave us a 5-star review. I think we have something like 22 5-star reviews now, which is, I don't know. The fact that 22 individual human beings have listened to this show just blows my mind. It's incredible.
Well, to be fair, I think 10 of them are us under different anonymous profiles.
That's right. Lustin Jesneski says that the show is pretty good, 4 stars.
That's how low self-esteem I have, that I can only give myself 4 stars.
But you should give us 5 stars. Perfect 5-star rating forever and always. The end. And then patreon.com/themidside. Patreon's a platform that allows you to financially support the show so that we can pay for hosting, advertising, equipment, etc. You sign up basically to give us a couple bucks every time we produce a show. Not when we take time off, not when we slack off and forget to do things, not when we jack off and forget to do things, but only when we produce content. That's when you give us money. That really helps us keep the lights on. Love lights. And if you can't do any of those things, that's perfectly fine. We get it. The economy blows. Thanks, Trump. But what you can do is tell a friend. Telling a friend is completely free. And this week only, if you tell a friend, then you can also tell another friend and give us 2 friends. Because I'm not giving you anything. This is your job, not mine. My job is to produce the podcast, okay? Excellent. I told many friends this week at work about the podcast, and I think we're going to gain like 3 or 4 listeners who found the whole idea of the show very interesting, especially the part where I plugged myself saying that we're going to be doing Woke or Joke next time. So they're all excited for that, and so should you be. If you like our other show, there's what's that show we do, Justin? Belichick Your Premises, a sports podcast coming out every Monday, Tuesday? I don't know when the show comes out because I don't
Tuesday.
Listen to it.
We record during Monday Night Football. You know this.
Do I? I've already forgotten. I'm so tired. So, and
go home and go to
until
sleep.
Until next time, much love, and I'm going to go to bed now. Goodbye.
This concludes your journey into the midside. I'm Justin Emblesneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.